The San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy. Independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 25, Episode 10, Sweden, Turkey, NATO, and the $23 billion F-16 deal. Talking with Dr. Rich Outzen. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Jim. Good to be with you.
Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan finally signed off on Sweden's NATO membership application January 26th. It was a complex, many-layered deal that took 20 months to come to fruition. With us today to unravel the story is Rich Outzen, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Turkey. He's a senior policy advisor specialized in Middle Eastern political, military, and security affairs, as well as the foreign policy of the United States. Hi, Rich, and welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Jim.
Great. Rich, there are so many moving parts to this story. Turkey, Sweden, Canada, Greece, Hungary, Ukraine, F-16s, drones, even disgraced New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez. There were so many twists and turns to this story, it was more like a tour of Istanbul's back alleys. Why was it so complicated for Sweden to get into NATO?
Well, the alliance has always been a complicated beast. And in this case, I mean both the NATO alliance broadly and also specifically the Turkish-U.S. alliance within NATO. There's been previous ups and downs, including the 1970s is what I still think is the ultimate low point when there was a mutual arms embargo and sort of a major crisis that extended for several years after the Turkish operations in Cyprus in 1974. So this one took some years to build into crisis, and a number of things were baked into that pie, so to speak. You have to go back and look at the falling out between Israel and Turkey starting in about 2009, which caused real concern in Washington because Israel, Turkey, and the United States in sort of a trilateral relationship, a pro-Western alliance, had been a bedrock of our policy in the Near East and in the Mediterranean for years. And there were high hopes that when President Erdogan, initially Prime Minister Erdogan, took over in Turkey, that he would actually make the relationship more commodious and more pro-Western. That really is not what happened. And increasingly, we saw as Turkey tried to achieve independence in its region in terms of its foreign policy and not linking it always to Washington's preferences, but to its own independent relations with actors that we sometimes were pleased about and sometimes not, and became more critical of other U.S. allies like Greece and Israel. Further, there were kind of problems on the very close defense industrial relationship. We had billions of dollars of bilateral defense trade for decades between Turkey and the U.S., mostly Turkey buying our stuff, but some of the other trade went the other way as well. But it's been a longstanding desire for the Turks to achieve their own defense industry, and largely they've done that over the last 10 or 15 years. They've started producing much of their own goods. Mm-hmm. But as part of that, they pressed for the U.S. to be more generous with technology sharing and co-production and things like that. And also they would occasionally flirt with other countries' systems, like looking when they didn't get the deal they wanted on Patriots in the early 2010s. They started looking at a Chinese system and then ultimately went with a Russian system, mm-hmm. the S-400. This became a big problem that ultimately scuttled Turkey's participation in the F-35 program. As a sort of a means to heal that wound, the idea of updating their F-16s came into play. So that's how that element came in. It was this long march of Turkey for foreign policy and defense industrial autonomy, clashing with the U.S. interest to have Turkey not buy Russian gear and to only buy American gear, mm-hmm. or at least to co-produce. So the second piece of this is that the U.S. became very concerned over the decade or 15 years prior to the present day over democratic conditions in Turkey. Certainly they have elections. They are a democracy, and yet they're what's often referred to as an authoritarian democracy because they don't observe some of the, what we would say, institutional checks and balances, perhaps, that occur in the United States. There was an attempted coup in 2016 mm-hmm. By factional elements that led to a very harsh crackdown in response to that, which, by the way, was very considered popular and legitimate, the crackdown was, in Turkey, because the Gulen movement that was seen as sort of being at the heart of, although not the entirety of this attempted coup, was generally believed to have been the villain in that story. It doesn't help that the man himself, Fethullah Gulen, is resident in the United States in Pennsylvania. But military officers that claimed loyalty to him were sort of behind the instigation of the failed coup in 2016. So you have that as well. There's events in Syria. I think it's well known that Erdogan and Obama diverged on how to approach ISIS, how to defeat ISIS, and the United States chose to ally itself with a group called the YPG, that is an armed militia aligned with the PKK, which has as its main target not ISIS, but Turkey. So we have essentially aligned with Turkey's number one enemy to go after another enemy that we both shared, which is the Islamic State. So many things led to this impasse. Now, the idea of sort of being able to hold Turkey at arm's length because of all of these bad things and Erdogan being unpopular in Washington, which he certainly is, was the animating policy for the Biden administration for the first 6 months to a year of his administration. So all of 2021, Erdogan wanted a meeting. Erdogan wanted a call. He didn't get it. Things change in February 2022 when we have the Russian invasion of Ukraine, or should I say the expansion of the Russian occupation and aggression against Ukraine. This reminded Washington and the rest of the alliance about the geopolitical importance of Turkey. It certainly chastened some of the members of the European community that had been reticent to join the military alliance NATO early on. This included Finland and Sweden. So that put a new energy, lit a new fire under Biden and NATO's leadership, including Stoltenberg and the Secretary General and others. So that led to this sort of concatenation of factors. Turkey wanted F-16s. Congress gets a veto on that and wanted to use it, mostly because of Bob Menendez. And others that are skeptical of Turkey, both on human rights grounds, but also because of the concerns of other regional actors, Israel, Greece, in the case of Menendez, Armenia as well. So what looked like a pretty straightforward deal to get the F-16s to start healing an old wound or several old wounds got wrapped up by Congress, who said, you know, yes, you want the F-16s, and yes, this will make Americans money. It'll help the Turkish Air Force and strengthen NATO deterrence. But we're not going to do this until you move on Sweden's accession into NATO. And that's the final piece of this puzzle, is that Sweden is not just a neutral country or sort of agnostic when it comes to the PKK. I refer to the PKK as Turkey's number one security threat, which it is. Well, Sweden, more than any country in Europe, has had up until quite recently terrorism laws that are very problematic in terms of the PKK raising money and recruiting and conducting propaganda. They strong-arm businesses in Sweden in order to get what they call kampanja, which is fundraising for the PKK. The reason is that up until last year's constitutional reforms, in Sweden it was illegal to conduct terrorist acts defined as violent actions on Swedish soil, but it was not punishable by law to advocate for a terror group or a group listed as a foreign terror organization by the United States and the European Union, which the PKK is. If you raise money for them, if you have rallies, conduct propaganda, none of that was punishable by law. So the Turks, with some justification in my view, looked to Stockholm and said, look, you want to come into the alliance, we want you in the alliance. And they've always said they are pro-NATO enlargement, the Turks have. They said, but this means that we're making a security guarantee to you. At a minimum, we would like to see some changes so that you are not aiding and abetting the number one security threat to our country, which was the PKK. So that led to about a year-long dance, during which time Sweden had a change of government from a sort of leftist government that was very tolerant of, if not even sort of fond of, the PKK and its broader movement, to a more conservative government that was much more worried about Russia and interested in fixing things with Turkey. They changed the constitution. They changed these problematic laws that had to do with tolerating a terror support activity. Things that would never pass in the United States were being allowed in Sweden, and that ended. So that set the end game up, because now Congress could say, okay, we've got what we wanted. The Turks could say, well, we've gotten some movement from Sweden in terms of prosecution of the PKK, and Washington could marry these two up. The only thing that was really holding that up as of late last year was Bob Menendez. And there were one or two others in Congress who basically said, yeah, well, maybe that's not good enough. That's the hoop we said Turkey needs to jump through. There may be another couple of hoops. So at that point, I actually thought this whole thing was going to fall off the rails. Lo and behold, the destiny or fate intervenes. Menendez is preoccupied and unable to continue in leadership. for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee because of a corruption trial. And I don't want to presume guilt or innocence until that all plays out, but let's just say it doesn't look good in terms of gold bars, money that he was taking and corrupt practices, not involving Turkey or any of Turkey's immediate enemies. It was actually over an Egyptian deal. With Menendez removed and with Jeff Flake, our ambassador in Ankara, who's a former senator himself, really working Capitol Hill and working the administration to line up behind this, the pieces finally came together. And when Turkey approved, the Turkish parliament approved, Swedish accession very shortly thereafter, the approval was sent by the administration to Capitol Hill for this F-16 deal. There was a 15-day period that had to be observed for objections to be lodged. That 15-day period has passed. And we really, with that, appear to have turned a new page in the U.S.-Turkey relationship. And that's to the good of NATO.
Well, so it looks as though at the end of this 20-month ordeal that Turkey got what it wanted, both in terms of having Stockholm change its terrorist laws and also having Washington agree to the F-16s. So it looks as though Turkey in that respect is placated. But then we also have Hungary, which is out there, which is now seems to be holding up Sweden's entry into NATO. Tell us about Hungary and Sweden.
Yeah, well, so Viktor Orban in Hungary and Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey are sort of kindred spirits. They're both center-right politicians with a thorny anti-globalist, pro-nationalist worldview. And they both have rather comfortable relations with Moscow, or at least let's say neither one of them wants to see NATO actively drawn into a war with Russia. So for that reason, they've been a little slower, a little bit more cautious on the expansion. I will say this, that Orban had said he won't be the last to approve. It turns out that he is the last, but he's indicated that he will recommend to the Hungarian parliament when it meets again in late February, because it's on recess now, that they approve this. This is similar language to what Erdogan used when he said, okay, my concerns have been met. I will recommend to my parliament that they pass this. Now, there were still 3 or 4 months after Erdogan said that before the Turkish parliament passed it. And one of those reasons is because the PKK, who has an incentive to scuttle this whole thing, to make things difficult between Turkey and Sweden and NATO, conducted a terror attack right when the Turkish parliament convened in the fall. There's not a lot of PKK in Hungary, so I don't think that plays out again. But there are people, I think, in the political spectrum in Hungary that would like to disrupt this. To be honest with you, I think when the parliament convenes in Hungary at the end of February, I think it's more likely that they do confirm this and approve Swedish accession, because they probably promised at most to the Russophilic members of their own government, and perhaps between Orban and Putin, who have a reasonably good relationship, he probably said he would draw this out as long as he can, but he certainly can't stop it. There will be massive pressure that's already starting to build, placed on Hungary to approve Swedish accession now that the Turkish veto has essentially been removed. So I expect that that will pass in the end of February.
Isn't there also an element of Swedish jet fighters and Hungary? Would that be part of a deal also?
Well, that's something that gets overlooked often, is that Sweden actually has its own very sophisticated defense industry. Small arms, armed vehicles, the Gripen in terms of fighter aircraft and so forth. So there may be a subtle, as there was with the Turks, and we didn't talk about this much, but in the case of Turkey, after the failed coup and after Turkish unilateral military operations in 2020 in Libya and in Syria, and to a certain extent assisting Azerbaijan in the Caucasus, there was a de facto arms embargo placed by Canada, the United States, and several other NATO members, including Sweden, that basically said, we're not going to sell Turkey anything because we can't control what they're doing militarily. Lifting that was part of the dance that got to this deal. It was about the same time that the deal was notified to Congress that the Canadians lifted their residual arms limitations on exports to Turkey, which is an odd thing to have for two NATO allies. But, you know, there we were. The United States, with the sale of the F-16, undid about 8 years of having no approvals of any major arms deals for Turkey. So, and of course, other countries like the UK had never observed such a ban. Germany had, but it was lifted. In the case of Hungary, it's less of a ban, and Hungary's military is much smaller. Their operational use of their military is much more limited than Turkey's. But there's probably still some backdoor negotiations about aircraft. It could be the Gripens. It could be other military gear that Hungary's needs would be met by the Swedish product. And they need to know, because, by the way, in Sweden, they've loved the Turkey bash for the last 3 or 4 years before the conservative government came in, but they've also liked the Viktor Orban bash. Mm-hmm. So I think in both cases, for Erdogan and for Orban, there is a possible military, industrial and military gear motive, but it's really more about being careful with your allies. There's an old adage that when you're talking about allies, you praise in public and criticize in private. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly not the way that NATO allies have treated or European allies have treated Turkey and Hungary. And of course, in both cases, there's lots to criticize. But I think one of the things that Hungary is trying to achieve with this, similar to what Erdogan was trying to achieve, is a little more discretion out of Sweden and how vociferously they condemn the authoritarian aspects of governance, either in Hungary or in Turkey.
Well, now that we're in the home stretch with Turkey agreeing to a full accession, with Hungary in hopefully in the final stages of agreeing to Sweden acceding to NATO, where does that leave NATO after this 20-month plus argument? Does this show cracks in NATO unity? Does it show a democratic process that worked in NATO and it will now be forgotten? How does this impact NATO, and particularly viewed by Vladimir Putin?
I think we've just stepped back from a deep precipice, right? Because if in fact Turkey, who's trying to develop its own fighter aircraft and will probably be flying them, pretty good generation 4.5 aircraft, in 10 years or so, their F-16s are starting to age out. They needed these upgrades on these new aircraft. If the rest of the alliance allowed Turkish air power to atrophy in that way, it would be a very bad sign in terms of conventional deterrence. And the ability to say, look, Russia, don't even get any ideas in Syria, in the Caucasus, or in the Black Sea about violating NATO airspace and conducting fait accompli, because there is a real power here. I'll point out there was an article last week after some Russian missiles overflew Ukraine, and part it was either drones or missiles, and the debris fell on Romanian territory. The aircraft that went to investigate and flew right up to the Romanian-Ukrainian border and conducted a reconnaissance was a Turkish F-16 flying from a Romanian base. So people who say, oh, yeah, the Turks are just in for themselves, that's not right. They're strengthening NATO's southern flank, and the fact that they're now going to get reinforcements to do that is a very good thing for NATO's conventional deterrence. And by the way, in terms of process, yeah, it was an ugly extended process, but this is kind of how the alliance has always worked. Go back and look at how what we now call Northern Macedonia, which for years was referred to as the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. They were held at NATO's doorstep and not allowed accession. Why? Because Athens, because Greece objected to the name. And this was in some ways a far less substantive objection than that the Turks had about PKK fundraising activities and recruitment in Stockholm. This was about supposed irredentist sentiment in Macedonia if they were allowed to keep the name. So the compromise was they went with Northern Macedonia, essentially foregoing any potential historical claims to Southern Macedonia, which is in Greece. That went on, if I'm not mistaken, for a decade or more. Mm-hmm. So this sort of stonewalling and hardballing, it's not that new. So the fact that it's worked in the end, or will be said to have worked if Hungary plays its part at the end of the month, I think is sort of a validation of the alliance structure. There's been some norming and some observing one another's sensibilities that needs to be done to prevent massive misunderstandings among members in future. So I think that aspect worked. If I'm Russia, I look at this and say, okay, I knew ultimately that these countries were going to come in, and I dragged that out as long as I could and sort of recovered my balance in the war. I think they're dismayed that the Russian war has resulted in an expansion of NATO, but I think they probably think they've played a bad hand as well as they could have, given the fact that Erdogan and Orban both made sure that while the war was in its critical phase over the last 2 years, that this accession didn't occur. In the historical sense, the expansion of NATO all the way up to include all of the Scandinavian countries now, Sweden and Finland, massive strengthening of our northern flank, the resumption of commodious ties between the U.S. and Turkey and the strengthening of Turkish Air Force, massive strengthening of our southern flank. It's all good news from that perspective. It was a little ugly how we got here.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, Turkey, with its 40 new F-16s added to the 79 existing F-16s that it has, will have a fleet of 119 F-16s, and I don't know about the rest of its Air Force capability, but that 119 F-16s on Russia's southern flank and right there on the border with Ukraine. That's got to be that Russia has to be taking notice of that. That does that tip the balance a little bit more in favor of NATO?
Well, I think it does, and I think the total numbers of F-16s may even be a little higher than that. I think they received a total of 270 F-16 C and D aircraft. Those are older models, admittedly, Block 30, 40, 50. And to be honest, the numbers of operational aircraft right now, I'm not up on you. You may be right. It may be closer to the 179. But what this does prevent is having F-16s fall out of the sky for lack of maintenance. So that's something Russia has to deal with. But I'll tell you that the aha moment for Russia with regards to Turkish military capabilities didn't happen because of these F-16s. It happened because of Turkish drones and the integration of drones with precision strike, both from manned aircraft and from ground-based systems, and perhaps most notably the willingness to incur casualties and to spill blood. The Turks did that in Libya, including fighting directly against the Wagner militia or mercenary group that is one of Putin's playthings. Or has been, as well as having its equipment and its operational doctrine employed by ally Azerbaijan against Russian-advised Armenians, and fighting and killing and being killed by the Russians in Syria, where there was fighting in Idlib in 2020. So what the Turks have shown that no other NATO ally has shown is not only do they have some systems that can threaten Russian aircraft and Russian ground forces, they're willing to go toe-to-toe with the Russians. There's many ways in which Russia has the advantage in such a fight. Mm-hmm. By the way, I'll add that Turkey has, you'll remember about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, there was this long debate under the late Obama administration into the Trump administration that should we provide Ukraine with lethal aid? Well, guess what? The Turks have been providing Ukraine with lethal aid since at least 2014 in various ways, and started with the drones, I think, in 2017. So they have shown that while they'll trade with Russia, they'll meet Putin to Erdogan, but they are a hard power player, and they're willing to employ that power, hard power, against Russia. That's a powerful additive to NATO's alliance deterrence, and that's why it's worth keeping Turkey inside the tent, so to speak.
And of course, Turkey with the with its foray into Central Asia, that organization of Turkic states that includes, five states, Azerbaijan, a couple of the stands in Turkey. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, so when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990-91, there was this sort of heady thought among the older generation of Turks that, at last, these historical cousins of ours, the Kazakhs, the Kyrgyz, the Turkmen, the Azerbaijanis, and the Uzbeks, that we, and to some extent the Tajiks, although they're not Turkic, so they don't have quite the same affection, that we will be able to talk with and trade with and have some sort of a common market with these people. But the truth is that none of the countries were ready for that at the time. The elites in all these Central Asian countries were still Russian apparatchiks for the most part, who spoke Russian. Many of them didn't speak Turkish in its various dialects. The Kazakh, the Kyrgyz, the Azeri, there are some dialectical differences, as well as they spoke Russian. But a couple things have happened. The first is that Turkey has developed over the last 30 years, since 1990 and into the current decade, much more impressive trade network globally, a diplomatic network globally. They have quintupled their diplomatic representations in Africa. They've greatly expanded it in Central Asia. Their companies have been doing construction work and electronics work, but also increasingly in the last 5 or 10 years, they've developed defense products, electronics, optics, and of course the drones, ground combat equipment that are useful to all of these countries. So they're now Turkish drones that have been sold to and are flying for Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan. Of course, they're being co-produced with Ukraine now. They're selling to Egypt. But strictly with regards to the Organization of Turkic States, you know, 30 years ago, they might have nodded when Ankara said, hey, we Turkic countries should all act together a little bit more. They nodded and said, yeah, but you're not the close big power. It's a little different now. Generational change has brought in new elites that basically need another balancer against the Russians, and Russia's weaker than it was 30 years ago, at least with regards to these Central Asian republics. They're looking for what they call a third force. The Central Asian states, especially the Turkic states, don't want to be that dependent on Russia or that dependent on China. They know the United States is not going to be that interested. But that third balancing power really is Turkey, because they have much, if not common, there's elements of shared history and language and culture. They're not pushing for this to be a strict military alliance, but they are developing the sort of a diplomatic and cultural and economic alliance. And I think that has great promise to be a stabilizing factor in Central Asia over the coming decades. They'll want to make sure not to get into a shooting war with Russians or Chinese or Iranians over Central Asia, but strengthening the ability of these countries to be self-sufficient and not satrapies of Iran or Russia or China. That's the game. And so far, it seems to be working. I mean, certainly better than it was 30 years ago. So the Turks see this as a major area of statecraft and diplomatic expansion for them. And I don't see a reason that the United States should not smile upon that, because after all, we're not going to be the savior for those countries. But if they work together a little bit better and they're not under the thumb of any other hegemon, that's all to the good.
Well, Rich, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, what are your closing thoughts about the bringing down the curtain, almost bringing down the curtain on this Sweden's application to join NATO?
Well, it's been said about American statecraft, I think initially by Europeans, it might have been the Germans who said that the Americans always do the right thing after trying everything else. In this case, we've tried a lot of things. We've tried, as you know, my dissertation was on U.S. coercive diplomacy. We tried sticks, a lot of sticks in terms of sanctions and threats and cajoling. We finally found a formula in Washington with a difficult ally, and certainly Turkey is that. They're not an easy ally, and they're not like Spain. I heard a U.S. Official about 6 months ago say, well, look, all we really want is for Turkey just to behave like a normal ally, like, say, Spain. Well, guess what? They're not Spain. They're in the Middle East. They're not on the Iberian Peninsula. And they have real security threats, and not just one, not just the PKK, but they have the Syrians and the Iranians and the Russians, all of whom would like to see their power decremented. So they have to play hardball. They have to do realpolitik. With a difficult ally, you have to identify common interests, and you have to make trade-offs. So finally, I think we got off the sort of the Heisman approach that extended into the early Biden administration and said, no, we're not going to talk with you because we don't like your head guy. And we said, okay, look, geopolitically, we have some things you want. You have some things we want. Let's make a deal. I, as a realpolitik practitioner, I'm a big fan of that. I think that that is a more pragmatic U.S. foreign policy. We should do more of it. Not that we shouldn't hold forth on issues of human rights and democracy and other values-based propositions. But those progress in those areas comes after. It's sort of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. First, you establish that you're both committed to one another's security. Once the security understanding is there, then you have the trade improving. Once the trade's improving, then your values converge. I think getting that hierarchy right is critical to effective U.S. statecraft. And I think this is an instance where we can say maybe that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Rich, what new projects are you working on?
Well, with the Atlantic Council, I've been co-editing a journal called the Defense Journal of the Atlantic Council in Turkey. It's available from the Atlantic Council's main website. If you Google Atlantic Council, Turkey, Defense Journal, or any combination of those words, you'll come up with it. We have our third issue getting ready to come out in March. And there's some technologically focused articles about drone warfare and the development of sort of new technology, especially unmanned technologies in Ukraine. We have an article on the F-16 Sweden issues that we just talked about. Then there's interviews with some American and some Turkish thought leaders. The journal basically aims at exploring the space in the NATO alliance and bilaterally of how we achieve common interest and how we get past the problems in the U.S.-Turkish relationship. So I also tweet a lot on, on X. I don't know, do I X on X or do I tweet on X? I'm in transition here, but I'm at Rich Outson on Twitter, so I put forth some commentary on that as well. But just trying to get geared up for the election and in November and see how that's going to impact all of these bilateral relationships, not just Turkey, but the host of other allies and our adversaries as well.
Give us the reference again for the journal, the Atlantic Council journal that you're editing.
Sure. It's the Defense Journal of the Atlantic Council in Turkey. So again, just Defense Journal, Turkey and Atlantic Council, all those, Google will bring it up. And
Well, once again, Rich, thanks so much for your keen insights into foreign policy, specifically the Turkey relationship, which is so critical to the United States with regard to the Middle East and NATO. And thank you for sharing that with us. And once again, I want to congratulate you on your being awarded your PhD, Dr. Rich Outson. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jim. I look forward to talking to you next time.
And for our listeners, today's episode is number 497. Listen to us on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms with listeners in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recently recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking us number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.